ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In 2007, four people vanished. It was dubbed a death cult. But after months of investigation, I don't think it's that simple. I'm Dominique Bayens, host of Expanse, The Nan Up 4, a story of people drawn into a 20-year saga they didn't ask for, who have spent decades trying to reconcile the choices they made that led them here.
The family lived a bizarre alternative lifestyle.
Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, installment three of the Ramadan series of The Mindfield. Welcome to it. We try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life, or sometimes just sidestep whatever's happening in modern life. Well, not altogether, but more or less. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Waleed.
I have been thinking about a conversation we had after the last episode that was off air. And we were talking last week about change and the changes of the heart. And then, I don't know if you remember this still, but do you remember we then had this back and forth between the three of us about all the different circumstances in which we do believe that change happens? Do you remember this?
Oh, yeah.
Which we skirted on in the show, but the bit that I remembered and I thought, you know, you say something, you go, oh, that should have been, I should have said that in the show. Yeah. It was one of those things where I was thinking about the way in which we, when we want to denigrate someone or put someone that we love in their place and call them back to something, the most common phrase we use is, you've changed.
Interesting.
Because of some kind of environmental thing. And I think the example I might have used was, you know, they've started a new job or they've moved up in the world somehow, or, you know, they've attained to some new status. And in that situation, the worst thing you can be is someone who's changed, right? I remember when... Well, this is going way back. Pat Rafter won his, maybe his second US Open. And I remember he described himself as remaining the same old sack of crap as he was before, which is a wonderfully Australian way of putting it. What was interesting there was the imperative behind it to show that he hadn't been somehow corrupted in all of this. I'm putting this on the table early because I think this is relevant to where we're going.
It is. It really
today.
Is. Yeah. You know, there is this moment, the German Lutheran theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who said at one remarkable point in one of his diaries, I don't know if he ever said it publicly, but he certainly said it to himself, that success can have the effect of, the term he uses is, it can have the effect of cicatrizing the heart. That success can do something to so toughen the walls of the heart that it becomes impervious to that which once moved it. One of the surest ways, in other words, of moving beyond a conscience that may remain, say, tender to the values, the things that matter to us, the inner orientation of our lives, one of the surest, truest ways of moving beyond a soft or a tender conscience is to surround oneself with a certain degree of success so that there are certain things that just don't need to move us. You know, this is something, if you were ever a poor student, you knew what it was like during term time or in between term time, not to have access to food. I've gone through long portions of my life without what we would now come to call food security, having to ration things out, having to work, you know, it's hard to imagine in those sorts of circumstances how you would ever take food for granted or allow food to simply remain wasted on a table. In much the same way, in a condition of having plenty or of having certain degrees of comfort or being in a situation where you suddenly find yourself elevated and therefore no longer have to play nice with the people around you, these can be some of the everyday circumstances in which that change, and I think what you're really describing here is change for the worse. The things that used to move us no longer do.
Which is why, to step back into the world very briefly, it was such a brilliant detail of succession, the you know, hugely popular TV show that dominated everything at the moment that it arrived, that they were always surrounded by enormous amounts of incredible food and no one ever ate it.
Yeah, that's exactly
Do you remember
right.
that?
Yes.
It was such an important, well, important maybe is not the right word, but it was such a potent symbol, I think, of the callousness of these people, that that's all this was just going to waste. It was there because, I don't know, it was worthy of them, but they had no appreciation for it. They had no need for it, clearly, because they didn't partake. But it had to be there in order to complete the picture of their full status.
In fact, the very first episode of season one of Succession includes images of household servants throwing out whole lobsters, for instance,
yep.
into black garbage bags and being taken away. It's part of the moral compass, which is to say part of the aesthetic condemnation of the entire show. You're right.
So clearly then, we do, to pick up the theme that I mentioned from the previous show, we do believe we can change. We seem only to believe it for the negative rather than for the positive, which we'll come to. Mm-hmm. We believe on some level, or at least we understand, that it is a product of circumstance, environment, exposure.
Can we simply say from without? I think from...
Yeah, okay, yes. I don't want to make it too hard and fast a distinction.
No,
but yes,
no,
okay,
no, no, you're sure. Right. I just, look, the only reason that I'm sort of checking this point ever so slightly is because I do fear that sometimes when we talk in terms of environmental factors or in terms of kind of conditionedness, that there is a degree of passivity, simply being receptive. We're not really sort of agents, or we don't have agency, or there hasn't been a, that's my one little check.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that concern. The thing about it is that what this overlooks is how often those circumstances are, at least to some degree, chosen. You do, in a sense, choose the people that you choose to spend a lot of time with. You know you do, because I just said choose twice in that sentence. You make decisions in your life about whether you'll follow this career path or that career path, and therefore what you will spend a lot of your time doing. Now, those decisions might be constrained in some way, but they're there nonetheless, at least for a lot of people they are. And then you have choices that you make or decisions that you make about how you will apply yourself to those things, what sorts of precautions you might take if you don't want to be one of those people who've changed and so on. So, yes, I'm with you on that point. But I think what I want to get to is, if change for the bad is possible, then change for the good obviously must be too, mustn't it?
Yeah.
And yet we don't seem to place a premium on those things. We don't seem to place a premium on putting oneself in the right kind of company. We don't seem to place a premium on making the kinds of decisions that would devote a huge amount or the lion's share of one's time towards something that has an effect on the person that we would regard as virtuous, for example. We don't seem to think about that. We don't talk about the practices that are attendant upon these sorts of changes. In other words, and this is coming to the theme of today's show quite directly, we don't think about those things which have the effect of softening the heart. Not much, anyway. We talk about people who might be soft-hearted, kind-hearted, big-hearted, so on. We don't tend to think about the kinds of things that got them there. And then even when we talk about environmental factors, do we talk about how they harden the heart? I don't know that we quite do that either. In fact, so I guess what I'm saying is, while the remnants of these sort of concepts still exist, maybe just on the edges of our moral imaginations, we don't really have the vocabulary anymore for understanding the heart in these terms, do we? Of hardening and softening, of that which becomes, well, we discussed last week, in the end sealed, and that which opens up. That vocabulary seems to be missing to me. And I wonder what you think the effects of that are.
I mean, I think I said in our very first episode in this series, which, I mean, if people for some reason are coming to it late, over the course of these 4 weeks of Ramadan, we are devoting ourselves to matters of the heart, to issues that attend to the heart really considering the heart not simply as an organ, although you made the right point when we discussed this with Claire Zorn last week. In the ancient world, there weren't a great many people that saw the way that we talk about the heart as merely metaphorical. The heart really did function as a kind of physio-spiritual or physio-moral organ. It was something that is at the center of the body spatially, in terms of the body's geometry. It's at the center of our lives. It's not all there is to life. It's not all there is to moral decision-making. But when the heart goes wrong, when the heart becomes disordered, when the heart, if we consider the heart as a kind of moral compass, when the heart places us according to the wrong bearings, pretty much everything else that we do becomes somehow, in some way or another, deranged or misaligned. And I think in many respects, that is reflected in the way that we use language concerning the heart. The heart has become something like mere sentimentality or emotionalism. The heart becomes mere want or mere desire or mere drive. Instead of conceiving of the heart, and this goes right back to ancient cultures, you can see it there in Aristotle, you can see it there in the likes of Averroes and Avicenna, in Al-Ghazali, the heart being a kind of shelter, a cocoon that we place around that which is most precious, that which is deepest to ourselves, that which is most fundamental to who we are, to what we value, to the way that we live, and therefore something that must be protected precisely because it can go wrong. There's this moment, Walid, and it is striking to me, the way that different religious traditions, different cultural traditions do refer to the heart. The heart is something that's often referred to as that which is naturally supple, which is naturally malleable, which can be damaged, which is inherently soft and delicate, and therefore which must be cared for. But at that very moment when we fail to care for it, when, to pick up precisely your point, when we place the heart, in other words, who we are, what we value, what is most precious to us, we place that in an environment that is characterized by inattentiveness, by heedlessness, that we surround ourselves with factors that have the effect of toughening, of hardening, of rendering it responsive to some things, usually self and ego, and unresponsive to other things, then what often happens is the heart is given over to a kind of derangement. So you've got the external language of the heart being sealed off, the heart almost being seared on the outside so things can't get in. But then when the heart is seared, what is the heart given over to? And here you have in the Jewish tradition, particularly in Talmudic deliberation, you have the notion of the heart being given over to the evil impulse, to something that is contained within it, that is unchecked, that is unmoved, that is unarrested by things from without. And there is this remarkable moment where Rav Asi in the Talmud, this is in Sukkah 52, where he says, first, the evil impulse is as thin as a spider's gossamer, but in the end, it becomes as thick as a cart rope. You have this idea that which is most precious to us, the substance of the moral life, our orientation towards that which is of greatest value, that which demands, which commands our responsiveness, that which also, which ought to respond to and respond and be responded to in kind by love, it can be as thin, it can be as delicate as a spider's web. But then when treated inattentively, carelessly, it then becomes thick, tough, rough, unresponsive, heedless, and ultimately that impulse then, if you like, if we think of the idea of the cart's rope, it then ends up dragging us in directions, in the direction of that which we truly value, that which we truly want.
You're listening to The Mindfield with me, Walid Ali, and my co-host Scott Stevens. Scott, does this take us in the direction of one of our great disagreements on this show, and that is the moral importance of intention? So when I hear what you've just said, what I hear is the moral importance, indeed I would say the moral paramountcy, of paying really careful attention to your genuine intentions in doing something. How easy it can be for someone to do something or embark upon some course of action that looks for all the world like it's good, but actually which is the beginning of this process. Because the motivations are something else. The motivations are for, I don't know, earning people's praise or
self-aggrandizement
or whatever it might be. They're very often, especially when you're talking in this kind of, at this spiritual level, there's no manifest difference to just the ordinary eye between this action and that. The difference is actually something that exists at the level of the heart and then has that effect. I know you have a lot of concerns about the moral role of intention. Are you with me that far?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course I am. Because my concern, I suppose, is that human beings often take a degree of refuge in what we believe our intentions were. This is not to say, and I don't think I've ever argued, that intentions are morally irrelevant. I simply don't think that intentions are completely or entirely morally determinative. So, for instance, I may have the best intentions of the world, or I might believe that I have the best intentions of the world, but those intentions have become so immixed, have become so intertwined with the desire for self-aggrandizement, for conflict avoidance, for ingratiating myself to other people, that something that might appear to me as being wholly other-focused or trying to achieve the best possible outcome, I may well, in fact, be, to some extent, deluding myself. And again, the people, these could be moral philosophers, these could be theologians who have scrutinized very carefully the inner life, the complex interior domain of human motivation. Duplicity, not being honest with oneself about what one is really doing, about what one really wants, can often produce a condition of self-deception where I believe, I'm telling myself a certain story about myself, about what I want, about who I really am. And all the while, I am inattentive to the things that my actions are actually doing to the people around me. So,
right, so that sort of self-deception, though, is a function of the state of the heart.
I think so.
Right, that's the point.
Yeah.
Which is why, you know, I think I mentioned last week, you might recall the poem that I referenced on the purification of the heart by Imam al-Mawdud. It's interesting because that goes through all kinds of diseases of the heart, but among them are those things that go directly to this concern, right? Things like, you know, seeking reputation, things like disliking or displeasure with blame, for example, ostentation. Might be another one. You might even say, in a slightly tangential way, but clearly relevant, that a disease of the heart being such as fearing poverty.
Yeah.
Right. I think that's, these things kind of become really important, and there's so many more, obviously, but these things become really important to gather together because they provide in some way the compass points by which you can determine when self-deception is likely to be or is more or less likely. It can be really difficult. I mean, you gave some analogies there. I think of the description that the prophet gave of what he called hidden idolatry.
Wow.
And that could be something like, that can occur in the performance of prayer itself, for example. So where you pray in a particular way and, you know, you might beautify your recitation and so on and so forth because you know people are watching and they might. And the description is terrifying. He says this can be this is harder to spot as an ant on a black rock in the middle of the night.
Perfect. Yes.
That this is extraordinarily difficult, but attention to it becomes so important because of the consequences that exist down the track. That one step after another, being heedless, and heedlessness, by the way, another disease of the heart. One step after another in a heedless fashion reaches a point where the heart becomes harder and more sealed.
It's almost as if that first step off course when then allowed to continue unchecked, you gradually become further and further and further from the heart of the matter, from
which we understand,
proper orientation. Yeah.
Yes, which we understand in contemporary language as, I guess, a process of normalization or something like that. Now, that's not to say that anyone who takes that first step is doomed. The whole point is that that's not true. But there has to be a process of accounting, self-accounting, that goes on, attached to quite intentional action, intentional practice.
Can I just
in order to be attentive to this sort of thing?
Yes. So can I just take us back then, just for one moment, to, I think, the fundamental idea of this series so far, and that is the heart is a kind of moral organ or moral orientation that faces two ways at once. On the one hand, the heart is that which is central to the moral life, if we can just put it that fundamental way. It's not, I think, the totality. I mean, there are forms of moral obligation. There are forms of moral reasoning. There are forms of ethical deliberation. And then there are various forms of political reasoning. But as soon as all of these things become uninformed by, unresponsive to the heart as that which provides shelter, as Al-Ghazali puts it, that which provides shelter to these other operations of human life, these other ways of valuing what is important. Once they become immune to the heart or unresponsive to the heart or uninformed is probably the best way of putting it, then something fundamentally goes wrong in these other forms of human pursuit. So the heart on the one hand has that integrating function. It is that which kind of holds together and provides that internal orientation to the moral life. But at the same time, the heart is also an outward-facing organ. It is that, in other words, which is and must be, in order for it to remain healthy, it must be morally responsive to that which is outside of us. And I think that, Waleed, is probably where the idolatry of intention can be best checked. If we are so drunk on, if we are so self-satisfied in, well, I did this for the best reasons, I did this with the best possible motives, and then you're heedless to the way that one's actual actions, the effects that they have on the people around, or even heedless to people being extremely forthright with us. Wait, have you considered? Have you thought about? Can you not recognize this as, in other words, the wisdom of people around us, or even just the wisdom of friends or of enemies or opponents? That's when the heart becomes more and more and more enclosed around the ego as idol. And this is where I think the language, so especially within the Jewish tradition, there are two things about the heart. One that is absolutely terrifying, and one that is the underlying goal. The thing that is absolutely terrifying that can happen to the heart is for it to be hardened. Within both Judaism and Islam, the Pharaoh of Egypt, is the
archetype.
He is the archetype of the one whose heart has become so sealed against God, God's self, that he is thereby damned. He is thereby cursed. So the heart, on the one hand, for it to become hardened so that one cannot hear the cries of the slaves of Egypt, for instance, one cannot hear the voice of God in the mouth of Moses, for instance, then the heart is desperately, desperately damned. But then the thing that is prayed for, and incidentally, certainly within the rabbinic tradition, prayer itself is known as labor of the heart. Prayer is a kind of softening, a kind of attendance to the condition of the heart. The thing that is so often prayed for is to have an understanding heart. But there the word understanding doesn't mean so much kind of, you know, comprehending or thinking. Understanding here is receptive. It's based on the word which means to hear, to attend to listen. So this idea of the heart as that which both integrates and directs, kind of like a moral compass, but also the heart as that which must be responsive to that which is around us, and therefore having a kind of acute attentiveness to those various ways in which we become unresponsive. Because as you were just saying, when unresponsiveness is compounded by unresponsiveness, before too long, you become, the faculty itself becomes, if you like, inoperative.
And here I would nominate two chief problems in our time and our place.
Great.
That are related. And that is problem number one, the unquenchable thirst for entertainment.
Sure.
Problem number two, a total avoidance of thinking seriously about death. They go together.
Yes, they do.
Because entertainment, the former distraction, the latter, right? The obsession with entertainment crowds out the possibility of thinking about death, and thinking about death is not entertaining. But once you elevate entertainment to that level, then heedlessness surely follows. Now, that's not to say entertainment is not bad, indeed essential as part of the human experience. But I immediately think of a statement of the prophet that has always intrigued me, where he says, too much laughter hardens the heart. He laughed. Humor was part of his life, and it was part of the life of his community, like any human community that happened. But the warning is fascinating. Because we think of course, laughter is the best medicine and so on, and maybe that is true. But of course, like any form of medicine, it has an appropriate dosage beyond which it may well kill you.
Hmm. It can, in fact, anesthetize the moral senses. That's right.
Yeah. This is something that I think just sounds profoundly radical in our age. I think the idea that we would be so overcome with entertainment, not that we get distracted from things that matter like real news or something like that, but that it somehow calluses us. And then I think about, I love comedy. You know that. Mm. I've worked with comedians and I always find them among the best colleagues I ever have. But one of the things that's interesting is as a discipline, if that's the way you have to view the world. I mean, comedy can be heartfelt, I guess. But very often it's about looking at things that are very serious and stripping them of that which makes them serious. Mm. Again, I'm generalizing hugely. You understand that. But if that becomes a practice, if that becomes an ethos, if that becomes a way of seeing, then it starts to be imaginable that we can see hearts be hardened, just as it can be the case with what we do. In the same way as a doctor becomes desensitized to the sight of blood or whatever, or a soldier becomes or can become desensitized to seeing death.
Or to killing.
Yes. So those things that we do have an effect on the heart, even those things we don't think about as having an effect. That might be pervasive.
Yeah.
And then the contemplation of death becomes a central pillar, I think, because, we should do a separate show on this. We wanted to once and then we ended up not doing it, didn't we? But it is that contemplation which actually lends meaning and direction to everything that comes before it.
That's right.
And without that, well then, who knows?
Just before we bring in our guest, I'm just going to flag this. We should do a show on death and on the cult of longevity.
Yep, okay.
Yeah.
I love these mid-show meetings.
Before we bring in the guest, there is a, and I'm reading this because it's part of the setting up for the discussion with the guest. There is an extraordinary moment right at the beginning of Primo Levi's account of his time in Auschwitz, if this is a man. He opens the book with a poem that is based on the Shema Yisrael, the Hear, O Israel, the attend to the word of God that appears in Deuteronomy 6. Primo Levi himself was not a religious Jew. Here he, I think, gets to the heart in many respects of what it is we were just talking about. And because I know that our guest wants to speak to it, I just want to read it briefly. It's from 1947, Primo Levi. It's basically called the Shema. You who live safe in your heated houses, you who come home at night to find hot food and friendly faces, consider if this is a man who toils in the mud, who knows no peace, who fights for half a loaf, who dies by a yes or a no. Consider if this is a woman with no hair and no name, with no more strength to remember, with empty eyes and a womb as cold as a frog in winter. Ponder that this has happened. I consign these words to you. Carve them into your hearts. At home or on the street, going to bed or rising, tell them to your children, or may your house fall down, may illness make you helpless, and your children turn their eyes from you. Thank you.
You're listening to The Minefield on ABC Radio National, where we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. This is the third episode in our Ramadan series. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. And now, Scott, we have a guest.
Our guest is Avril Alba. She's Professor of Holocaust Studies and Jewish Civilization at the University of Sydney. Avril, having read your work for so long, it's a great pleasure to finally have you on The Minefield. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here. And what a wonderful, wonderful introduction you've both given. I want to stay with Levy, if that's okay, because I think what Levy does in framing his work, his seminal work, really, If This Is a Man, or was called Survival in Auschwitz in its American publication, with this poem, is to both bring us back to the core of what the Jewish tradition demands in terms of what love is and what love is meant to do in the tradition, but also secularizes it. Because in the post-Holocaust universe, for Levy, of course, the covenant is a problematic structure, right, because of its theistic nature. And of course, the Shema, the original prayer, is in essence a rearticulation, a rabbinic rearticulation of the Sinai covenant. And why does one have to say it every day? Precisely, Scott, I think because of the point that you made, which is that one, it's not really hear, O Israel, right? It's a terrible translation. It's understand, get it, right? And understanding is not something that you do once, right? The rabbis, I think, and this speaks, I think, to some of the points that you were both making, the classical rabbis have a very, really a very conservative view of human nature. They are suspicious, right, that we will so easily be led off track, right? So the prayer service, in a sense, is a safeguard around that. The prayers are a safeguard around that. They are to consistently, in a sense, if you like, knock you back into thinking about what it means to be in covenant, to be in right relationship with God. And so, of course, in the original Shema prayer, the covenant or the agreement comes about because of both your fear and your love of God, your desire to be in right relationship. Right? And from that premise, everything else unfolds, the actions that you need to undertake. And that's another, of course, fundamental point, is that it's not simply about belief. It's not about a declaration. It's about what you will do as well. So there's all these guardrails. Now, for Levy, of course, in this post-Holocaust universe, the covenant can't be guaranteed in the same way. And for Levy, it is the figure of what he calls in his other books and in a chapter in that book, the drowned, the Musulman, right, that one must hold oneself attentive to. And through that, you will come to understand what it means to act ethically, right? In some ways, it has resonance, I think, with Levinas and with the idea of the face of the other. It is the other that will allow me, in a sense, to make the ethical choice. But I think what's key, and again, something you both touched upon, right, is that you can be indifferent to that, right? And Levy is very, very aware of that. And so in those beautiful words, those very, you know, poignant words, there is punishment, right? And the punishment is a destruction to you as well as others, right? You will suffer the consequences of your indifference if you do not hold the face of the one that suffers in front of you.
Can I put a question to you both? There are two things about Levy's poem that just struck me afresh as I've been rereading them. The first is, I've never really read the words, and these are biblical words fully as much as they are Levy's, to inscribe something on your heart, to carve something, to engrave it. Doesn't that presume a certain disposition towards, a certain tendency towards hardness? I mean, isn't the very idea that there's something that has to be engraved, isn't that a kind of reminder that left to itself, the heart can give itself over to that undirected, that too great a hardness? And the only other thing, just about the poem, then I'm going to hand it over to the two of you. Do you notice the way that Levy frames the possible condition of hardness? It's not affluence. It's comfort. It's convenience. You who live safe in your heated houses, you come home at night to find hot food and friendly faces. There is something about, and I think this goes back to a concern that Waleed has expressed for a long time, our longing for, our lust for convenience, our disdain for being inconvenienced. That itself can lead to a condition of moral unresponsiveness, moral inattentiveness, and then left really unchecked to heedlessness to that which is all around us. Those two points, the heart, is it naturally hard? Is that one of the things that is part of the condition of the heart? And then the dangers surrounding everyday conveniences and comfort. These are the two things that really, I guess, concern me as we progress through the show.
I think that's right. I think what you say really resonates for me in the how we even understand the heart, right, in the biblical tradition, the rabbinic tradition, and other religious traditions, because it's obviously it's not the heart of the popular imagination. It is, as you say, a sort of a spiritual, physical kind of notion, but it is something that has the ability to inform our understanding, our will, our moral deliberation, right, our positioning, our posture in the world, I guess, is a way I would try and think about it. And I think when we talk about inscribing on the heart, I actually see it differently. I almost see it as like an opening up of the heart. And it reminds me of another biblical phrase, to circumcise the heart, right? And what does it mean to circumcise that? To bring the heart back into right relationship, right, to covenantal relationship, whether that be in a theistic sense in the classical text or with Levi in a much more humanistic sense, but to move the direction of the heart, and that is possible. That to me, I think, speaks to that notion.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder, this is going to take me far beyond my expertise, I wonder what the original Hebrew word is. Do you happen to know for inscribe?
Oh, to inscribe. I'm going through the prayer in my head. But it is to write.
It is to write.
Yeah, now this is important,
yes.
Right? Because I was thinking about this. There's a similar hadith of the Prophet in the Islamic tradition, which sometimes gets translated in a similar way, that something gets inscribed. But the verb in Arabic, I'm not going to go into it because I might get it wrong, but as I glance at it just now, carries more the idea of a mark or something being written. But I'll tell you the hadith because maybe that explains how these things get reconciled. So the statement for the Prophet says, indeed, when the servant, that is the servant of God, commits a sin, a black mark is inscribed or appears on his heart. If he abandons the sin, seeks forgiveness and repents, then his heart will be polished. If he returns to the sin, then the blackness will be increased until it overcomes his heart. It's the covering that God has mentioned. And then a verse, no, rather a covering is over their hearts from what they have earned. That's the Quranic verse that's invoked there.
That's almost more the idea of a stain, isn't it?
Kind of
corrosion.
And that's why I wonder if the translation of inscription perhaps is doing a little more work than the original might do. Because when you think of something as inscribed, you can't undo it. But no, in the Abrahamic tradition, of course these things can be undone. That is the role of forgiveness. That is the role of religious practice. That is the role of turning towards virtue. I don't know if it's a more complicated scenario in Christianity.
There is a kind of overwhelming pessimism concerning the heart. The heart is that which is corrupt. The heart is that which is kind of naturally in its very state, that which goes awry, that which wants evil.
Within the Christian tradition you're talking
about. Yeah, yeah.
So I guess that's connected to the idea of original sin or something, which is absent from...
That's exactly right.
...the Islamic and Jewish traditions.
Yeah.
That sounds to me more a description of what, in Arabic anyway, would be described as nafs.
Mm-hmm.
Often translated as... Well, sometimes it can be translated as like the self, but it often has the connotation of being the lower self, the base self. But that's quite a separate thing from the heart. I don't know, Avril, if that has any Jewish resonances for you.
It does. It does, because I think that particularly as we move into the rabbinic period, the rabbis, I would say, are increasingly suspicious of the heart. I might put it that way, right?
That's true.
They are much more guarded. And I think there's a beautiful conversation that happens in the Talmud between Rabbi Akiva and another Rabbi Ben Azai, right? Where Rabbi Akiva, cites the Levitical, love your neighbor as yourself. This is the greatest principle, right, of Torah. And Ben-Azai says, no, this is the book of the generations of Adam. Now, what does that mean? What Ben-Azai is referencing is creation, right? Is the creation of Adam, the creation of humanity. Why is it a greater principle? Because Ben-Azai is the conservative here. And he's saying, no, your heart can't really be completely trusted. But what can be trusted is if I remind you of creation, you will remember that we are all created, B'Tselem Elohim, right? In the image of God. And therefore, if you see the image of God in others, you will treat others in the way that you should. So I think it's interesting. The primacy of the heart, of course, is there, right? The command to love is throughout the Hebrew Bible, is throughout the rabbinic texts. But it's not always seen as the most trustworthy of organs, should we say, in terms of our actions. There are other guardrails.
You're listening to The Mindfield on ABC Radio National. Well, late, my name's Scott Stevens, my co-host. That voice that you just heard belongs to Avril Elba, who's Professor of Holocaust Studies and Jewish Civilization at the University of Sydney. Scott.
It may just be a throwaway line, but it stopped me in my tracks in one of the initial sections of Martin Buber's great work on dialogue. There's a moment where he describes the process whereby human communication becomes communion. It's a really lovely description. We go from speaking words to one another to those words, because of their tenderness, because of their attentiveness, because of their truthfulness, they draw us closer and closer towards one another, so that it's not just these incidental words that hold us together, but rather something that we have discovered in one another and therefore ourselves, this kind of deeper moral relation. He talks about this moment where, then having said that, we look at one another in the heart of the eyes, in the heart of the eyes. Now, he may simply be meaning, you know, directly in the eye or a pupil or something like that. But it immediately brought back to mind this connection that Al-Ghazali makes between the heart and the eyes, in the same way that the eye is attentive to the light, and by means of the light, the eye is able to see. The eye can be damaged, so it can't see as it should. So too, the heart is that which is open to the light, which is open to disclosure, to truthfulness, to moral discovery. And the heart, too, can be ruined, can be made hard. And it just struck me that there is this condition, and we've been talking about hard-heartedness, but maybe one of the other ways of thinking about this is to go back to this phrase that I often bring up from Stanley Cavell, the American philosopher, where he talks about a condition that someone can reach not because of the absence of something. It's not that we don't know enough. It's not we haven't learned enough. But rather because of the presence of something: callousness, coldness, inattentiveness, an addiction to a kind of lustfulness or voluptuousness, where there are things that we want and therefore we surround ourselves with. Due to the overmuch presence of something, we fall into a condition of what he calls soul blindness, where I look at the human being, but I no longer see in the human being a soul that is worthy of either love or attentiveness. And it just strikes me that so much of what we've been talking about in terms of kind of unresponsiveness, one of the ways that this manifests itself is in a fundamental failure on our part to be moved by that, to be stopped by that, and then to render ourselves responsive to that which is worthy of our admiration, love, respect, or even simply our attentiveness, being willing to stop in our tracks and tarry in the presence of this thing. I wonder, Avril, about this connection between the eye being able to see as it ought, in other words, being able to see morally, being able to see lovingly and attentively, and the heart being able to, I don't want to say feel as it ought, but respond as it ought to that which is outside of us.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, when you spoke, I immediately thought of Levinas, right?
That's true.
Because Levinas's fundamental claim, you know, which is, I guess, it's an upturning of a sort of Kantian vision of ethics, is that ethics begins outside of us.
That's right.
Right? It begins outside of us. It begins when we see the other, not when we turn inward. And I think I see that as well in Levy's writing. And I guess Buber is more, you know, it's more complicated in the way that you describe, where it's almost like a fusion, right? It's like like this turning, total turning towards. But I think...
I think what it is for Buber, I mean, the thing that he prioritizes is neither the I nor the thou, but what he calls it, deswischen, the space in between. And it's that space in between that needs to be perpetually attended to so that we can see as we ought, so that we can speak as we ought, so that we can hear as we ought, and so that we can respond as we ought.
Yes, absolutely. And also I think that we can have respect for the space, if that makes sense, that have respect for it, to not immediately assume that we understand the space in the same way as those that we are seeking dialogue with, right? I feel that particularly, I think, in the way that Levy looks at the Musulman, right? Because Levy is very, very careful to say in all of his works, we are not those who have hit bottom, right? So even those who survive, we are not the ones that have hit bottom. And it is those who have hit bottom, it is the Musulman, it is those who have drowned, right? Levy's drowned. They are whose face we need to see. And we have to respect that as well. And I think it's a sort of, it's a warning, right? It's a warning to us. Don't indulge a sort of a fantasy that you truly understand what it means to have been there and to have died there.
I mean, this immediately reminds me in the Christian tradition of the ability to see is it the face of God?
More or less, yeah.
I'm going to butcher this horribly, but even the most abject of people. Mm. Now, this is, in its way, one of the founding ideas behind the whole scheme of human rights that we talk about in a secular context.
Mm. Inalienable dignity.
Mm. Right. And yet that doesn't seem to get us very far, does it?
that's not the language of the heart. That I think that's what Stephen Darwall would say, for instance.
Right. Is that what's going wrong there for you, Scott? That it's appealing to a matter of the heart, but it can't speak the language of the heart. And therefore, ultimately, it falls?
Maybe it's simply not sufficient. Really, for me, the best analogy here is one that I often draw with the political philosophy of John Rawls, where he says the point of the institutions of justice, the point of just structures and certain commitments to justice as fairness or universal human rights, the purpose of that is to cultivate what he calls the just sentiments. In other words, even if these things were to fall over, we have been so, can we say, the concept of justice and the commitments to justice as fairness have been inscribed upon our hearts.
Would you say that's what's happened, though?
No.
Yeah.
No, these things, we have so externalized them that we have almost delegated the responsibility for justice to impersonal institutions and impersonal mechanisms. Such that we no longer feel, and here I think even the language, I don't know how you feel about this, Avril, but I think even the language of obligation only gets us so far. You know, there is an ought. I mean, that certainly is the space that Emmanuel Levinas, the other demands something from us. He even, sort of certainly in the latter part of his philosophy, refers to the other as holding us hostage. There's not the kind of parity between us that, say, Martin Buber would advocate.
It's also very much the language of law.
It is very much the language of law to a point. But I think what's interesting is that at a certain point, the externalization of obligation being drawn outside of ourselves to something beyond ourselves, it has to be matched by and it has to cultivate the conditions of the ability to love. Mm. The ability for that commitment to emerge from within so that even if the conditions didn't exist, and you know, this is certainly Levy, these camps were lawless. And the struggle of humanity within the camps is that even when surrounded by lawlessness, does one attend to the beauty of the humanity of, for instance, the prisoner in his room who is overwhelmed by dysentery? Even in those conditions, is there something from within that wells up that says that even this person who is suffocating, even this person is worthy of my heartfelt attendance?
Mm. Yes, absolutely. You remind me of the other wonderful survivor writer, Imre Kertész. Oh, yeah. You know, we're at the end of the book, I'm probably not going to paraphrase it well enough, but he says, you know, even in the camp when they're in the roll call and it is abject, right? It is such an abject state that they are all in. And he said, but he remembers there was a certain moment in the day where the light in the camp brought beauty, you know, and you think like that, you know, in a sense, that is the moment. And when you were speaking, Scott, about what else is necessary, my thoughts went immediately to Abraham Joshua Heschel, because I think for Heschel, the heart is also, it's not only about how we live well, but the heart allows us to feel the wonder of the world, right? To feel what Heschel calls radical amazement. Right. And that in a sense, I think, is what is perhaps missing from our more legalistic understandings that we were just touching upon, right? Is that we forget the human capacity for wonder, for radical amazement, and that is also part of what the heart needs to do, and that the heart has to remain open to that, to avoid the sort of hardness that we began our conversation with.
Well, which takes us back a couple of Ramadan series, right?
I was about to say.
Yeah, qalbin la yakhsha, a heart that cannot feel awe.
Yeah.
That's something from which we should be seeking refuge. The legal thing is interesting to me, though, because I wonder... See, when we talk the language of law, we are talking the language of restraint, aren't we? That which restrains you. Mm. That which draws a limit that you can't transgress. It stops you doing things you might otherwise want to do. That's the way we tend to think of law. That's a very secularized understanding, then, of how we should manage these things or negotiate these things. It's why we fall back onto things like codes of conduct when we have a problem that occurs in an institutional setting or at work or whatever. It's also, I think, one of the great misunderstandings that those speaking a secular vocabulary have of law when those who are speaking a religious vocabulary use it. That they don't understand it as something that has a connection to the heart or the inner life. They understand it as something that is about the control of the external, which is the way that secular law works.
Yes.
But it's fascinating then that we have this thing called human rights law. Whatever state of disrepair we think it might be in, or however relevant we think it might ultimately be in the conduct of states and institutions, but we have it there. And yet it's predicated on this thing. It's predicated on this thing that we can't really prove in a materialist, empirical way. And I wonder if the predicate is the thing that's under threat.
Wow.
Too much?
No. Avril, do you want to respond to that?
I think the one of the really interesting points that you bring up is the conception of law, you know, what we think law is. And I think... you're absolutely right that certainly if you think about the very nub of law in Judaism, of course, is the covenant, right, is the agreement. And the covenant is a very, very fine balance between law and love, right? That is the intersection of the covenant, right? Because if it was only one or only the other, it would actually become either just a rod for your back, you know, it would just be sort of an automaton kind of universe. But if it was only love, it would have no force, right? It would have no force in the world, really, to make change in the world. And so it's always
balancing.
And
no rigor. It would have no rigor.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. And so it's always in that fine balance that the supplicant, I guess you could say, is trying to maintain relationship toward God. Right, to be in that right relationship, to be in that covenantal relationship, is to walk that line between love and law.
And so what would a secular version of that be? Some kind of reverence for the system and the institutions that produced these things? For, I don't know, democratic exchange, for the parliament? I mean, certainly there's certainly a relationship between a collapse in trust in institutions and trust in things like government, and then our feelings of antipathy and hostility towards policy and also towards each other. There's something there. There's something there to be extracted. I don't know exactly what it is. We'll have to end there because we are out of time. Hey, Avril, thank you so much for dropping by.
It's a pleasure. Thank you both.
Avril Elba is Professor of Holocaust Studies in Jewish Civilization at the University of Sydney. Our guest for this week's edition of The Mindfield, the third in our Ramadan series, which will conclude next week. That is it for this episode, of course. You can catch us next week on ABC Radio National or anytime you like on ABC Listen. See you soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.